This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We do not know who murdered former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko with an obscure radioactive isotope in London this fall. We also do not know who shot and killed Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya in Moscow earlier this year. Just a couple of weeks ago, former Russian Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar claimed that he'd been poisoned in Ireland. So far, there's no explanation for that either. However, there does appear to be a pattern of threats and assassinations of critics of Russian President Vladimir Putin that many lay on a shadowy network of former KGB agents. President Putin himself, of course, is a former member of the old Soviet Union's Committee on State Security. After the fall of communism, the KGB was split into two, but across Russia today, many former agents hold important positions in business and in government, and critics say the killings are part of a broader pattern that raises important questions about power and politics in Russia. Later in the program, a congressional delegation visited Cuba over the weekend. We'll talk with Representative William Delahunt of Massachusetts about who they met and what they learned. But first, a look inside Russian espionage, its practices and power in modern-day Russia. If you have questions about what's happening and why, give us a call. We're especially interested to hear from those of you with experience in intelligence. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. We begin with Andrew Meyer, a former Moscow correspondent for Time magazine, who's working on a book about the history of the KGB, who joins us now from NPR's bureau in New York City. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil.
And I wonder, does the Litvinenko murder look like the old KGB to you?
Well, the Litvinenko murder is a hornet's nest and much more. And I think that as fascinating and intriguing as it is, and it's obviously occupied the front pages both in this country and across the world, especially in Europe, for weeks now, it doesn't get us very far if we start looking at all the different dots, trying to connect them. As you said in the intro, this is a very murky world indeed. And connecting the dots, it's sort of like if you were to create a Wikipedia page on Litvinenko murder, it may exist. There'd be a million links and we would click ourselves to eternity and it may not get very far. That said, as you also mentioned in the intro, there has been a series of very high-profile murders, and you named a few of them. I would go back even further to the murder of the American journalist Paul Klebnikov, who was the editor of Russian Forbes, who was assassinated in Russia in 2004. There have been a number of liberal deputies murdered, and, of course, most recently, before Litvinenko, the Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. So this is something that bears more than coincidence. Two points I would try to bear in mind in any discussion of this is one, when I first started working in Moscow as a correspondent, I met with a high-ranking then President Yeltsin's assistant, and he said we were talking about conspiracy theories, which Russians love conspiracy theories. They thrive on conspiracy theories. There's something about the country since, I think, Ivan the Terrible, conspiracy theories have been bred in Russia. And he said something very simple, which I've always tried to bear in mind. It's useful as a reporter, but I think it's also useful as a reader, as a consumer of news, especially when we look at the Litvinenko case. He said, any conspiracy theory takes at least three steps. And in Russia, we usually screw it up on the second step. And I think that is instructive. That said, and maybe we can get into this in a little bit, we are in a period of extreme crisis and tension in Russia. And it has not, in many ways, it's been obscured by the murder of Litvinenko in London. This is what I call September 1999, when there was a series of apartment bombings in Russia, which led to the rise of Vladimir Putin. He was then the prime minister. And as we all know, he became president on New Year's Eve of that year.
This was a series of bombings blamed on Chechen extremists. And Mr. Litvinenko, among others, was among those who said, no, it wasn't the Chechens. This was the KGB.
That's right. That's one of those many links, you know, that people are sort of playing with now. And it gets you into a million. It's sort of a recursive cat's cradle, if you will. But Litvinenko, that was one of his main points. And that was the book that he co-authored. the first book that he co-authored was about those apartment bombings and who was behind them, and we still don't know.
And again, getting back to Chechnya, the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, she was a leading critic of human rights abuses in Chechnya.
She certainly was, and she. I actually was in Chechnya with her. We were not traveling together, but we were there together at one point. I was shocked, and having been in Russia for most of the last 10 years, well, a decade before that, you are not easily shocked if you've lived in Russia that long. And when I got the phone call from Moscow that she had been murdered, certainly the murder of Khlebnikov, an American, was shocking and seemingly nonsensical. Politkovskaya as well. And that's sort of controversial to say because she was the single strongest voice speaking truth to power in concerning the Chechen War. That said, she wrote for a very, very small newspaper, Novaya Gazeta in Moscow, which is on the internet, but the actual printed paper only goes to a very small circle.
Well, and to be fair, I think it was The Economist which once this week described Mr. Litvinenko as a man who was completely unimportant until he was murdered.
Right. This is one of the central questions when you link up all these murders. They don't all fit the pattern. But Khlebnikov, again, to get back to that murder, why was he killed? We still don't know. He really wasn't raising. He was known as an investigative journalist when he was working for Forbes. But having been in Moscow at that time, when the first issue of the Russian Forbes came out, he was all pro. He wasn't 100% pro Putin, but he was pro the new generation of businessmen. He was very upbeat on Russia. He was actually on the record as backing Putin in Chechnya. Sergei Yushchenkov, who was one of the liberal-minded deputies with a military background, he was shot dead outside his house. At that point, he was a completely marginal character on the fringe of politics. As you said about Litvinenko, he was somebody who was sort of a gnat, by no means even a wasp in the Kremlin's mind. So although the remarks coming out of the Kremlin from Mr. Putin on down have been, let us say, blunt and brusque, to give him the credit that he probably doesn't deserve on those remarks, certainly with regarding to the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, these were not significant opponents. There is no significant opposition in Russia today. And that's, again, the point to bear in mind.
Yes, the media has been suppressed. Their political process, there's a presidential election coming up next year, but it seems to be, the jockeying seems to be whomever Mr. Putin will choose.
Well, that's when I say that we're in September 1999 all over again. The last years of Boris Yeltsin, while they made for great copy in the Western newspapers, were a period of stagnation that we haven't seen, that the Russians hadn't seen since Brezhnev. But it was also this sort of Wild East, which has become famous now in a number of books. And Russians remember that very well. When Putin came in, suddenly you had law and order. You had the war in Chechnya and you had a semblance that there would be a rule of law. Now, there is again a jockeying for power, and there are two lead candidates, both of whom are close proteges of Mr. Putin. One who, like him, is what we call one of the Siloviki, the men of power, men from sort of the former KGB, now FSB, and the Interior Ministry and the power ministries in Russia, those men who come from there, the alumni, and it's a very large old boy network. Are called Siloviki. And those are the two, Dmitry Medvedev, who's only 41, and Sergei Ivanov, who are seen as sort of the leading contenders. It's a moot point because, as you said, at the end of the day, Vladimir Putin will, should this election continue, should the election go off in 08, he will be the one appointing his successor.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. Our guest is Andrew Meyer, former Moscow correspondent for Time and working on a book about the history of the KGB. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's start with Yana, who's calling us from Wyoming.
Yes, I was going to say that the Russian society seems to always have thrived on a conspiracy-type intelligence. I don't know if it's a cycle that can ever be broken. I think when the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, collapsed, there was part of our government that just really felt that, well, now we're finally rid of the KGB. But I just don't think the mindset will ever go away.
She's Yana's clearly being distracted by some other more pressing pressing issues there. But Andrew Meyer, you were talking about the conspiracy culture in not only the Soviet Union but still in Russia.
Well, I think she raises a good point that it's sort of two points within Russia. That mindset, that Cold War, if you will, mindset does continue. There are certainly as difficult as it is, it's not impossible to see and to understand that this is a nation that was when the Soviet Union existed. They believed they were Velika Derzhava, a great power, and one of the great tenets of Mr. Putin's rise is that he promised to make Russia again proud. This was a nation that was insulted and injured. They had lost the 15 republics of the Soviet Union. And then they fell into an economic freefall. Mr. Putin has more than enough of his share of problems on hand. That said, thanks to the rise in oil prices, it's become a very strong, robust petrostate, flush with oil income. So the KGB mentality exists, but you have to be careful. One thing I do when I talk about this, like to point out, is that it's not the era that I'm working on now and researching my book. It's not the 1920s and 30s where you have agents overseas conducting operations. Are there spies in the West? Of course there are. And there's certainly Western spies working in the former Soviet sphere. But these are a new generation, like Mr. Putin, who's a post-war president. You have people within the Kremlin and around it, in various fields, whether they are in business or in politics, who are Western-oriented. Many of them have been educated in Europe and in the States. They may have MBAs. They have Blackberries. They have laptops. This is not your old-time, Boris and Natasha KGB agents.
We're talking with Andrew Meyer about the continued power of the old KGB in Russia today. After the break, former KGB General Oleg Kalugin joins us, and we'll have more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As the investigation continues into who killed former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko in London, we're taking a look into the underground world of Russian espionage. Our guest is Andrew Meyer, a former Moscow correspondent for Time magazine, who's currently working on a book about the history of the KGB. Of course, you are welcome to join the conversation. If you have questions about these shadowy networks and what's happening now, give us a call. Especially interested in hearing from any of you who may have experience in intelligence. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And we want to bring another voice into the conversation. Like Alexander Litvinenko, a number of outspoken KGB agents left or were forced out of the agency. Oleg Kalugin, a retired major general of the KGB, spoke out against the agency in the 1980s. He served in the Russian parliament. He's since found refuge here in the United States. He's currently a professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies in Alexandria, Virginia, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. It's a pleasure to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you.
And you've spoken out against the Russian government and against the KGB and against its remnants today, and I wonder, you look at Mr. Litvinenko and the other cases of people who've been killed, are you nervous?
Well, I am used to the idea that I may be targeted. Ever since I became a vocal critic of the Soviet system, when the system was very much alive, I knew it may, something may happen to me. In fact, I was charged with treason in Gorbachev's times, mm-hmm. in 1990. I was stripped of my rank and decorations for my vocal attacks on the Soviet regime, but I was saved from jail by the people of Russia when I was elected a member of the Soviet parliament, and that allowed me to be even more vocal in my criticism of the system. But ever since I moved to the United States, I never thought I would stay here for a long time, but Mr. Putin, my former subordinate, in the late 1980s took over as the chief of the Russian security services, and he called me publicly traitor. I responded publicly by calling him a war criminal ever since. Well, my choice has been made. I applied for U.S. citizenship. I'm a U.S. citizen now, but I'm aware, Alexander Litvinenko was a British citizen too. Mm-hmm. Well, and unfortunately, he's no longer with us.
You're not expecting a Christmas card from the Kremlin this year?
Not really, but I did receive a number of threats, anonymous. Once it was really funny in such a flowery language, quoting some French philosophers, and in the end saying how beautiful cemeteries are in the United States. One day you belong to one of these cemeteries, and there was a return address. I checked it. It was a funeral house in Seattle, state of Washington.
Now, the KGB back in your day had certainly a lot of blood on its hands, and Andrew Meyer is pointing out that whatever's going on today, certainly nothing like the 20s and the 30s, but nevertheless, was there a turning point for you? When did you say enough is enough?
Well, let me tell you, when Yuri Andropov took over as chairman of the KGB, and that happened in 1967, and I was pretty close to that man, and I would listen to some of his deliberations on the issues. In fact, when I ran the Directorate of Foreign Counterintelligence, one of my functions was to locate defectors. They were all sentenced to death automatically, and my job was to locate them, and someone else will kill them. At the time, we did find a number of people, and Andropov would say, no, I'm against political assassinations. Mm-hmm. So on his watch, three deaths happened. One is an infamous case of Georgi Markov, who was poisoned by the Bulgarians, but the poison was provided by the Soviet KGB. Another case is that of former Soviet defector, a naval officer, Artamonov Shadrin. He was sentenced to death. Andropov said, let's kidnap him. And during the process of kidnapping, when he was dragged across the border from Austria into Czechoslovakia, he died of a heart attack. And finally, that was an order by Andropov, but again, it was sanctioned and apparently by the Soviet Politburo members. When Hafizullah Amin, president of Afghanistan, before he was shot, gunned down by the Soviet crack units which stormed the palace, mm-hmm. he was given poison. He was dying. And the Soviet doctors who served him, they tried to, revive him. And when the troops, moved in, he was just shot. And his four-year-old killed was also shot, by the way. Mm. So these are the three cases I'm aware of, and I don't believe there were any in Andropov's time. In fact, ever since Gorbachev took over and the reforms started, until 1998, I do not recall a single case of politically motivated assassination. They all started since 1998. I would say that's when Putin took over as chief of the Russian security services and later as president of Russia.
And I wonder, Andrew Meyer, does that history jibe with what your research shows? Excuse me, you're trying to get back to Andrew Meyer in New York, yes.
It does, absolutely, but I think Oleg Kalugin is being too modest. He has a far greater role to talk about in each of those cases and knows the history from the inside. The point, though, to get back to Litvinenko, in 1998, when he first sort of came into the public eye in Moscow, he held a press conference with five other members then of the FSB, and I was there at the press conference, and it would be a little bit of a difference with Oleg's chronology in that he said Litvinenko, that is, said he made the accusation that he had been ordered to execute the then ruling, reigning oligarch in Moscow, Boris Berezovsky, who then, of course, became his patron and mm-hmm. is now living in exile in London. That predates 98. At that time, Vladimir Putin was head of the FSB, but the accusations went back to actually 97.
Hmm. Well, let's see if we can get some listeners in on the conversation. Let's go to Nick. Nick calling us from San Francisco.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Nick.
My question to the two guests is, in recent times, we're finding that Putin is not as much in control as we all like to believe he is in the West. And with these two recent political assassinations of Litvinenko and Politkovskaya, how much control does Putin really have? And is this group behind him, the Siloviki, the real decision makers? And Putin is not even in control of the situation as much as we all like to believe he is. I'd like to get comments from both of you, and I'll take the, your comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Nick. And Oleg Kalugin?
Well, I don't buy this argument, which is quite popular in the West, that Putin is not in charge. He is totally in charge. He runs the Kremlin. And ever since he took over, a number of his political opponents were assassinated. Let me remind you of the names of two Russian legislators, Yuri Shekochihin, who was poisoned. That happened in 2003, I believe. Now, Sergei Yushchenkov was gunned down. Both were members of the investigative commission while trying to find out the roots of these bombings of the Russian apartment houses in 1999.
Now, going back to that original sin, as it's
been
described.
That's correct. Yes. And they were both assassinated. Now, Anna Politkovskaya was also involved in similar activities. She openly sided with the Chechen Liberation Movement, and she was gunned down. Well, in fact, one of Putin's closest allies and his bodyguard in St. Petersburg, when Putin was deputy mayor of the city, by name Roman Tsepov, also died a mysterious death. He was poisoned. That happened about 2 years ago. So, current president of Ukraine, Yushchenko, was poisoned. He fortunately survived, but his face has been deformed. Litvinenko is the last case. And why Litvinenko? Because he was so fierce, so violent in his attacks on Putin, and not so much on his policies, but on Putin's personality. That's what made him different. Mm-hmm. I read one of the last installments of Litvinenko's, and I thought, this guy is in trouble.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what you think, Andrew Meyer. Is there this shadowy rogue group?
Well, I think there's, as in all things in Russia, especially today, there are many, many more shades of gray. And as I'm sure Oleg Kalugin knows well, as I said at the outset, you can connect the dots that way. Those dots are very strong, but you can also connect them almost an infinite number of ways. It's not to say Putin is a saint. Anyone who's read my book, the big book I did on Russia, Black Earth, understands that I'm no fan of Vladimir Putin. But as I say, you don't need to start doing political assassinations if you want to blacken the name of Vladimir Putin. You talk to the people at Shell who are now looking at losing their $20 billion, the single biggest investment in Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union, to they're being muscled out. It looks like they will be muscled out by Gazprom, the national giant gas corporation. Anyone who's paid even a cursory interest in Chechnya knows that Grozny, the Chechen capital, suffered the worst bombing of any city in Europe since World War II. If you look at the Russian health crisis, there are catastrophes across the country. You don't need to take out someone like Alexander Litvinenko or even Anna Politkovskaya, because there is enough out there already on the record to blacken Mr. Putin's name. That said, you can easily connect the dots that way as well. Mm. But as I said at the outset, it doesn't get us very far. One thing I would point out, though, is that although Mr. Putin came in with this strong backing, it's a question of seeing where we're going to go now. With the complete elimination of independent media, there really isn't a very strong avenue. We had a recent, over the weekend, protest led by the former chess master Garry Kasparov, who is trying to raise an opposition party. There is no freedom right now to raise any kind of democratic opposition within Russia.
Hmm. Well, let's get another caller in. This is Gintas in South Carolina.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. My name is Gintas. I'm a second-generation Lithuanian living in the States. And I wanted to ask Mr. Myers, is there any validity to the fear amongst the Baltic countries that Putin will try to repossess the Baltics in the next 5 to 10 years, even though that we've recently become part of the NATO alliance?
No, I think this is part of, you know, when, and to a certain extent, it's the fault of the reporters, both in Moscow and in Europe and in the States. As I said, you don't need to do too much to blacken Vladimir Putin's name. But this is a man who's extremely bright, and he has amazed those of us who saw him rise in 1998, how well he's performed on the world stage. The last thing he wants to do is to do something that will hurt Russia's prestige abroad. He knows he has enough of a PR problem as it is. Does he want, as I said, a great power? Of course he does. But it's much easier to do just a little bit of window dressing now and then. The war...
But he does not seem to be above bullying some of his neighbors, particularly
using... No, I was just going to say, the war of words with Georgia has gone beyond the war of words with Georgia. Whether it's Georgia or Chechnya or Ukraine, as Oleg Kalugin mentioned, those are real economic and political interests above all with the West. Anytime George Bush mentions Georgia, Vladimir Putin flies off the handle in their one-on-one meetings. When he talks about Chechnya, which I think is probably very rare, he flies off the handle. Similarly with Ukraine, less so with the Baltics. I think that they realize that this is about an economic power, just the way Putin brought in Gerhard Schroeder, the former chancellor in Germany, onto the board of Gazprom, the gas giant I mentioned. Mm-hmm. The KGB is no longer the old KGB. It's a sort of the sleek new version wearing $2,000 and up suits. They know that they have economic power now as a petrol state.
Thanks very much for the call. We're talking about the KGB, the old KGB, and the new Russia. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get Masha on the line. Masha calling from Naples, Florida.
Yes, my name is Misha.
Oh, excuse me. I apologize.
That's okay. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling, first of all, about the Russian feeling of, you know, conspiracy. My family, my mother and brothers and sisters and I came to America in 1978. And although I was a small child, you know, she was petrified of the KGB coming to find us. I don't have specifics, but my father apparently worked in some of the more... for lack of a better term, black ops of the KGB, and we were able to basically escape. And to this day, she will not talk to any Russians. She is petrified. She's convinced that I have cousins that were here from the 80s that are supposed sleepers. You know, and this is something that I find is a pretty common belief amongst a lot of Russian expatriates that I have met.
Hmm. Misha, does she know that you've made this call?
Pardon?
I'm half joking. Does she know that you've made this call? Does she know that you have an interest in Russia and Russian politics, especially the KGB?
She would be very much in fear. Mm-hmm. I myself am a little more realistic. I mean, who are we? We're just Americans working a basic job.
Well, I'd like to hear Mr. Kalugin's opinion as an expert from the inside. If you say you emigrated in 1978,
yes.
And your grandfather might have been involved in
his father.
Your father was involved in.
I don't know exactly what he did, but he mentioned, I heard something, the term GRU. I don't know what that is. I don't know what he did, but I know that it was bad.
GRU
is
military.
I'll let Mr. Kalugin handle that one.
Okay.
Well, in the late 1970s, as I mentioned earlier, all defectors from the Russian security and military services were automatically sentenced to death. Well, whether they would be executed, and I said it again earlier, Andropov was against political executions. Well, things have been different lately, and I say it again, some people have illusions about Mr. Putin. I have none. He was my subordinate many years ago, and I saw him grow. I know his bio better than many other Russian leaders, and believe me, we deal with someone who is capable of many things, but he will never attack the Baltic states. He is a realist. But to restore the Russian Empire, that's one of his greatest dreams. Actually, he stated it publicly. The demise of the USSR was the greatest international event and catastrophe of the 20th century. So bear that in mind.
Misha, we wish you and your mother good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Absolutely.
The phone call. And I wanted to thank Andrew Meyer for his time today. Appreciate it coming in.
Thank you, Neil.
Andrew Meyer, former Moscow correspondent for Time magazine, now working on a book about the history of the KGB. He joined us from our studios in New York. Oleg Kalugin, appreciate you coming in today,
too.
Oleg Kalugin, a retired major general from the KGB, now professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies in Alexandria, Virginia, who was kind enough today to join us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we'll visit Havana by way of Boston. We'll be talking with Congressman William Delahunt, part of a congressional delegation just back from Cuba. 800-989-8255 if you have questions about what he learned and who he talked to. 800-989-TALK. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.